My name is Dan Spencer, and the title of the forum tonight is U.S. Foreign Assistance, Aid or Obstacle? And I want to say just a word about forums at Holden Village. We set up forums to try and generate lively conversation. So the aim of the evening is not necessarily any kind of consensus, but rather that we hear a variety of viewpoints and perspectives, and that everybody's perspective is respected and honored during the time. We've set up this panel because we think it's going to give us some variety of viewpoints and perspectives. We've got Al Cui, who has spent time in the U.S. Congress and so dealt with foreign policy questions from that perspective. Jane Rossing, who has been a missionary for 5 years in Senegal and before that in Zaire with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, working on development projects. And Phil Anderson, who has worked in a variety of different occupations, but most recently with Lutheran World Federation in El Salvador, but also covering much of Latin America. And so we hope that we're going to have each of them speak just for 3 or 4 minutes and then open it up to the whole group for conversation and questions and debate. And we will begin now and stop promptly at 9:30, even if we're in the heat of discussion at that point, because we'll encourage you to carry the conversation beyond this room into the coffee break and other areas. We're going to move from my right and to my left and begin with Al Cui.
Well, thank you, Dan. As you got me on the correct side of the political spectrum.
Carefully arranged here. Right, middle, left.
Let me make some general statements about foreign aid, because I never served on those committees. But it was enough of an interest to me because my predecessor in Congress, August Andreessen, never voted for any foreign aid bill. He voted against the Marshall Plan, and I was always upset about that. And so in the years that I was in Congress, I never voted against the foreign aid bill. And so the same congressional district had the reverse of it. And it started out because of the influence of people at St. Olaf College, and I was a student there. And I felt at that time, when you're thinking now of not so long after World War II, of the United States being an island of prosperity in a sea of poverty in the world. So the rebuilding of Europe and Japan was important to me, plus reaching out in other parts of the world. There was also some motivations that I had, and that was that we try and work through either private organizations or else multilaterally, because I felt it was a problem with the United States giving direct aid because of the strength and power of ours and the temptation to use it for but mostly for political purposes and would be misconstrued. My motivation was, again, reaching out to help people. The other part of it is, as it went on, I came to the conclusion that we ought to depend a great deal on loans, but subsequently loans have gotten countries in deep trouble. We aren't in deep trouble the same way that we run up a big debt in this United States as well. But a principle that started fitting through all of the legislation that I developed, I did not do it in foreign aid because I'm not on that committee, was that the people who are benefited should have a voice in how they're developed. And so domestically, that I became known as the one who pushed that legislation all the time. For instance, when the poverty legislation was developed, Office of Economic Opportunity, it was my amendments that required that one-third of the local councils be made up of representatives of the poor. And not people representing poor, that they weren't poor themselves, but people who were poor representing themselves. And in the education legislation, that there would always be parent advisory committees, not only to the school district, to the schools. And always those who are receiving assistance to improve themselves, we wouldn't be doing something to them, but enable them to do things for themselves. Because all the years that I was in Congress, I came to the conclusion that there's nobody smart enough to tell you what to do, but if you give people the facts and the information, it'll be sorted through their heads as wisdom that we can be more confident of than one person calling the shots.
Jane, why don't you give us from your perspective on working in Africa? Tell me a little bit about what you've done.
Okay, I've spent 5.5 years in Senegal, and so that's especially what I'm going to talk about. I've just come back a couple months ago. But U.S. foreign aid up till maybe a year ago, I looked at totally from the outside. I mean, I had very few friends who worked in the U.S. Agency for International Development, we'll probably talk about it as AID, or in any way with the U.S. government. So I really just saw a few effects, especially from the perspective of my friends who are Senegalese people living in my village. One of the main things that we saw all the time was a program of food aid called Program for the Nutrition of, Promotion of Nutrition and Health or something like that. And basically what it was U.S. food going to women, pregnant women and young children, similar in a way to the WIC program in this country. That was the idea when it was set up, and it was administered through Catholic Relief Service. Catholic Relief Service is one of the largest private United States organizations working in relief and development, and gets a lot of its money from the U.S. government. So I call this U.S. foreign assistance because all the food was coming directly from them. And, you know, all kinds of stories with that. Certainly it helped numerous people. It helped, you know, thousands, perhaps millions of people, because this program was all over the country that undernourished children, children who fell short of the norm for that age, would be given food. But of course, the food is given to the family. And it really pointed up, seeing this over and over again, that anything you get, whether it's food or anything, is really economic help. Because, of course, the families used it for whatever they felt like. I remember one time that the leading politician in town, I was visiting his wives, and they were cooking up, and they said, isn't this wonderful? We have all this food, and it was U.S. Cornmeal at that point. They said, it's so nice that the U.S. government gives us this food. How else would we feed all our political guests here? But of course it was supposed to go to the malnourished children. So I mean, food always gets mixed around. Finally, Catholic Relief Service said, we're not going to administer this program anymore because there's too much corruption, there's too many problems. And it seems that the U.S. government was very disappointed that they wouldn't take more food, because that of course is one of our objectives in food aid around the world, is to get rid of a lot of our surplus food. When I started working more closely with the, well, not with them, but at least in a sense with them, was when we had a very serious refugee problem, at least serious for us, small in world terms, but large if you're in your little region, about 60,000 refugees poured into my area of Senegal from neighboring Mauritania after a long political situation that I won't explain here. But there, emergency aid was clearly needed. There was no other way that those people were going to eat except by foreign aid. I mean, it was a clear emergency. And so all the organizations, Catholic Relief Service, us and the Lutheran Church, and everybody started accepting, again, U.S. grain. And I really think it saved the lives of a lot of people. Most of it came through what's called the World Food Program. But again, it's UN, U.S. foreign assistance, but given to the multilateral organizations. The World Food Program falls under, I think, the Food and Agriculture Organization. It doesn't have the United Nations. Anyway, it's a United Nations program. But all the food, basically, that those 60,000 people ate for a long time was U.S. food. So it was really funny. I mean, the government people were very happy that, once again, we were willing to you know, private agencies were willing to use the food in saying that perhaps this isn't doing harm. You've probably heard a lot of the arguments against food aid otherwise. I mean, it does decrease local production. It can suppress prices. Where I was, it didn't, because prices were all set by the government. So it would have little effect on that, except the government is perhaps able to keep them low. I think U.S. foreign aid has a lot of disadvantages as compared to private agencies. The people who work there are rarely going to be of the same dedication, the same willingness to, I don't know, endure harder conditions. The people I know with the U.S. government tend to live very well overseas. There's tremendous amount of paperwork that needs to be done, and you certainly need to know that a lot of the money goes into that. But in Senegal, the main foreign donor is France, far and away. And so I come from a very different perspective than Central America. I mean, there's a lot of reasons we come from a different foreign perspective. But in Senegal, U.S. is sort of the little guy kind of coming in with more creative projects. The huge, overwhelming country that has thousands of soldiers there is France. So the U.S., I can say that I saw it doing pretty creative things in family planning, basically the whole family planning system of the whole country is funded by the U.S. and is free, almost free, to people who want it. So that is important to me, because I see it as a women's rights issue, choosing how many children you want to have. They are able to try a lot of things with new technologies, with solar pumps, and have a mandate from the U.S. Congress now that has to support women in development. Of course, that's very important to me. So just a couple comments is that anything you do overseas is political. Just, you think giving food to a country is just a nice thing to do, but of course everything matters who you give it to, because most of the food aid is sold, and I certainly saw that. But as long as you give it to people who are in an emergency situation, it can be very helpful. And the other thing is, organizations like Bread for the World are encouraging an increase in foreign aid, and I think that's important that we know that our aid can help a lot of poor people. People are poor, they need money, and we are a very wealthy country and certainly have a responsibility to that. However, it's not automatic that our foreign aid is going to help poor people, and that's what we really need to keep pushing. We need to be the advocate for the poor who have no advocate in Congress. So some aid helps, some hurts. How's that for me sitting in the middle?
All right. We got a perspective from within the political process, perspective from where the United States plays a smaller role but a very creative role, and seeing both pluses and minuses, and Phil has that experience in Latin America where the U.S. has a much larger role.
I was thinking back to Pope John the 23rd, his words in the 1960s, development, the new word for peace, and in the last 3 decades, the United Nations and the member nations have supported decades for development. And looking back now, the United Nations itself recognizes that these have been 3 decades of failure in looking at how we as nations go about doing development. And that's a severe critique about foreign assistance, not only from the United States, but the UN bodies, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, Organization of American States, the Inter-American Development Bank, and the bilateral assistance that comes from all of the nations. I don't think the problem is so much with the concept of foreign aid. I think within Latin America, the people that I know who are adamant critics of U.S. foreign policy in the region would favor U.S. aid to the region if it were not so tied to other political interests. That is, they recognize that their countries are poor. They recognize that in order to generate the economy, there needs to be certain inputs. The problem becomes in how those are tied, often to other objectives. In the case of Latin America, often to military interests, which is a part of foreign assistance. There's a very excellent analysis now, a few years old, by Food First, or the Institute for Food and Policy Studies, called looking at U.S. Foreign assistance, and it's entitled Aid or Obstacle, something like that, which I would recommend. Much of our U.S. foreign assistance goes to not the most poor nations of the world. Israel is number one, followed by other countries, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, again for some not so altruistic reasons vis-a-vis the war in Afghanistan and what that means with the Soviet Union. So it's a knotty issue, the whole area of foreign aid. I like what Al says very much, that what has come to be very fundamental in work and development assistance is people's participation, if there is not that, and that means coming from the very conceptualization of what needs to be done in a community, very likely any given project will fail, whether it's a water project or an agriculture product, project, a housing project. If it does not come out and be born out of the people with their total participation, creativity, their own energy and inputs, it will fail. And those efforts which simply dump money onto a given situation ultimately will fail. Within Latin America, vis-a-vis what is U.S. foreign policy, I think it's very clear, and we haven't changed much our foreign policy since 1823 with the Monroe Doctrine, which basically said that the Latin America hemisphere is our sphere of influence, basically to keep what we call the Latin American countries independent, that is, of European influence, that these countries should develop on their own. And we've gone through a number of different styles throughout the last 150, 160 years, including much intervention. That's our leading U.S. policy role within the region, primarily around the end of the last century, the Spanish-American War in Cuba. Then, and even earlier in Nicaragua, setting up virtually in Nicaragua a U.S. colony for a time. And then into this century, where there's been numerous interventions in the Caribbean, in the Dominican Republic, most recently under Lyndon Johnson, 1964, Guatemala, back in the Eisenhower era, 1954, Grenada, under President Reagan in 1983, I believe, 84, and most recently in Panama, 1989, December. There have been other moments where the leading edge has been human rights under President Jimmy Carter, where in order to get assistance, there must be improvement on the way in which governments and their militaries behave vis-a-vis the human rights of people, cut aid to Guatemala to zero, cut aid in Brazil, which is a massive human rights violator. The non-interventionist policy of Franklin Roosevelt in the 40s, the Alliance for Progress era of John F. Kennedy, those two eras, Roosevelt and Kennedy, ultimately have not shown the fruits which perhaps their intentions desired. Again, trying to inject money into the region. Certainly with Kennedy, it was another way of intervention, as we saw particularly in Brazil, that set up the whole national security kind of state and apparatus that was responsible for the control and the repression of many, many societies. I see one gentleman reading Penny Lernoux's book, Cry of the People, where she documents that very, very clearly. Right now, we're at the tail end, perhaps. Well, I'm not sure it's ended entirely. The primary policy goal is U.S. security, that we've built an illusion that what takes place in Central America, particularly in the Caribbean, has something to do with our security. And so there cannot be another Cuba. There cannot be a communism like that. And therefore, the policy since President Reagan was in office was to contain any efforts for revolutionary change. Now, within that, a lot of issues. Has development really been effective in Latin America? To some degree, yes. For some people, yes. And there is a certain amount of trickle down. Huh? But the vast majority of people are poor or poorer than two or three decades ago. They have less land. They have their money goes less far. The Latin American countries have gone into extreme debt. $350 billion of debt. Mexico, $80, $90 billion. Argentina, major debt. So it's left an entire legacy, and much of the idea behind that was to pump money in for development.
Okay, we're going to open it up for everybody now. This is your chance to ask questions of the panelists, to share your own perspective that maybe hasn't been articulated, or other experiences you've got. We jotted down some questions on the board which may be helpful to be thinking about, such as what are U.S. foreign policy goals? What are some of the methods? What's at stake with U.S. foreign assistance? Is it effective? And for what ends is it effective? So some questions you may want to consider, but have at it now. Whatever your thoughts may be on U.S. foreign policy assistance. Are we give too much, too little? Are we giving it correctly? Are we giving it to the right folks? Do you agree with some of the panelists, disagree with them?
I've been really exercising personally the concept of letting go and letting God. And I'm just wondering how that concept fits with people that are looking at such horrendously large problems, and we're also infinitely small in perspective. And this question is asked of any of the three of you is how do you let go, how do you let God, how does God talk to you, how has God led you in the past, and how can we tap into God's guidance in attacking such huge problems?
I'd be glad to get started.
Sure.
On that. Anything you take as a principle of like letting go and letting God as though is hands off everybody and is either totally as if they're going to operate. I believe, as I said, that the individuals themselves need to be involved in their betterment. But I think there's also a place for international action. Take, for instance, in Africa. I don't know how in the world we're going to help them recover that continent unless internationally, not I mean outside of the continent, but within the continent, the governments meet together and agree that they're going to have reforestation and grass being grown on that land. Now, we learned the same thing ourselves in the 1930s, because if we had continued in our agriculture in the 1930s, we wouldn't have been able to feed our people in World War II. We'd have been in the same situation as the Soviet Union was in World War II. Now the Soviet Union's even worse, which is a different reason. But the way our agriculture was operating then, but because of and national effort through the Soil Conservation Service, and at least that, and for a while there were some messiahs who were preaching that. There got to be a change, so we did change our agriculture and the way we operated. I think we're making some mistakes now, we're going to get ourselves into trouble again, but I think that, that is an indication how you could do it, where the states work together through a federal agency, and I think you have to do that as well. So I think you have to do it both ways.
But my question isn't a laissez-faire one at all. It's that concept to me means, we have to be very, very involved, but it's with God's guidance, His will, not ours.
Yeah.
And how does God lead you? How does God guide you in what your participation is going to be in the solution?
I think it's with a view as stewards of this earth, a responsibility that we leave it in a better shape than when we found it. Again, that's the motivating factor behind it. That's where I see God directing us.
Jane or Phil, do you want to? I know, Jane, you talked about needing to be advocates for the poor. Is that?
It's an enormous question what you ask. I guess I would say that, God. I mean, is our faith reminds us that each person is a cherished creature of God. It's not acceptable to say that problems in Ethiopia are too enormous. We're just going to have to let some millions die because we got tired in 1984. Besides, it's political problems and the government is terrible. I mean, the government is terrible, but that we need to keep working. I mean, I think it's the same questions that all of us face every day. I mean, how does our Christian faith shape our actions? And I think it's no different whether you're working overseas or whether you're working here in this country. It shapes our lives.
Oliver North felt he was working on behalf of God and the U.S. government.
Yeah, I think that's a loaded question, but within Latin America, at least from where we've been and working closely with the church in development issues, there's a sense that God is active in history, and the primary locus of God's activity in history is for liberation, for the fulfillment of the dignity of the person in community. And so the place where we have to be and we have to let go with our schemes to be among the poor. I don't think Ollie North put himself there. And that may be a difference, not to say that we or the churches have fully accomplished that, but going back to what Al said, the people's participation in this activity. Who are the people for whom development is of prime interest? Huh? It is the poor. And now there also has to be a critique then of those who are very rich and oppressive. And their ministry really has to go on as well to touch their hearts. Though I'm not sure that gets through. And that's where we get into kinds of revolutionary change. Those who have power, those who are in authority, often their hearts are hardened. But still, the people of God go to Pharaoh to ask that the people are free. But it's not easy to work in the development arena, and there are some discouraging moments about it. I think that the most encouraging kinds of things are to be among the poor. To be with the people. That's where at least I have found my stimulation. When I am discouraged, the way to pick myself up again is to go back and be with the people. Perhaps because what they have is hope. They may not have enough beans and tortillas for everyone, or what they have, they will share. And so that kindles a lot of hope.
There was a question over hand over here.
Well, I was considering the massacre in Tiananmen Square in China. Received a lot of publicity, and it has a lot of negative connotations with Bush when he went into a favored treatment. But the opposite of that is the thousands that have been killed in Latin America that doesn't even consider. Many more killed there than were killed in that massacre, and that's the press doesn't seem to care about it. And the Congress argues about aid that we know goes to sustain that regimes and stuff that are involved in that. Why?
Now that really gets at that one of those questions about what are U.S. policy goals and its foreign assistance. Something similar to that is astonishing to me, that the proposed aid package, I think, for Poland is greater than all of Africa for U.S. assistance. And yet, where is the need greater if you were to compare those two situations? So, again, what are the U.S. foreign assistance goals? You got a case, like you said, the massacre in Tiananmen Square, but we had massacres ongoing in Latin America.
Well, I'd say the chief aim of our foreign policy is to sustain our economic system. Our economic and our political system, which is subordinate to our economic system. And I think God is saying to us today, through what's happening in nature, that the whole shebang is up for grabs. That there's no way you can continue the kind of economic growth that we have. There's no way you can sustain that growth in other countries without simply destroying the earth, the habitat, the human habitat. And I really think that God is speaking to us very, very strongly. Listen, and you've got to just gravel around and grovel around in that data. There, Mexico, for example, is supposed to stabilize its population. It's now about 80 million at 193 million. Can you imagine what the Rio Grande boundary is going to be when you get 193 million people in Mexico with the economic system that they have now? Washington and California, what are they going to be? They're going to be armed. There's going to be another Berlin Wall there. How else could you possibly keep starving people when the whole process is coming here? I think God is really saying no to most of what we're all about.
So you're saying, Al, that from your perspective, U.S. foreign assistance is propping up an unfair system that is perpetuating problems.
It's a system that has its justification, but it's a system that is destroying the world. Therefore, I'm not questioning a lot of motives and things. Although one could, but I think the things that we personally are involved in right now and are involved in all the time are part of a system that is destroying the world. And so development, what we have to do is develop our own life in such a way that the way we live could possibly be relevant for anybody else. I don't think our way of life, you can't take it around the world. Imagine what happened if we emitted as much carbon in the world per person as we do. You'd have five times as much carbon out there, and the global warming would just shoot up. I was trying to reply to this question. What if you let God speak to you? You know, really begin to listen to the vibes of the world. It's overwhelming. Failure.
I am a little pessimistic. Usually I'm not pessimistic, but I'm a little pessimistic on God speaking to the United States in a very clear way who will do something about it. I'm more optimistic The spiritual revival in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, because there the Christians have been suffering for such a long period of time. And I think there's a powerful strength that's going to come from them. And at least here in our society, we have been talking about polluting our environment and so forth, but that large industrial empire there kept it all under wraps, but since Chernobyl, that is not the case any longer. I just think that there are things evolving there that gives me great hope that there will be some changes in the world that will have an impact on us. So that's just my view right now. And the second thing I would say is I think the human rights really take precedence. And what struck me at the Peace Prize Forum at Augsburg College, where President Carter was present, and all the speakers indicated that a change had been made with President Carter that continues on to where human rights now have a dominance in State Department policy that they did not have before, and it was not dropped with Reagan. I thought it might have been, but all of these speakers, most of them Democrats, claimed that it had not been. To me, that's a hope for ourselves that there might be some change in the way. What is the U.S. policy? I mean, always the country is self-interest. But when you do put human rights above anywhere as it goes above where it was before, I then get a more optimistic view.
Bill, did you want to say?
Yeah, I think that's very good. I think we are at a new moment, a new opportunity. It's a matter of grabbing hold of that. It's the question of Ethiopia, I think, may be a case study in how the international community can try to respond. And that bridges East and West, Soviet Union and the United States, where, again, food, use of food, which is essential just to get it in there. A lot of times I've been very critical of, like, the PL 480 food program, because it is dumping corn or dumping wheat in areas. There was a case after the Guatemala earthquake, 1974, 1976, where part of the function of the non-governmental organizations was to buy up U.S. Commodities to get it off the market, because it was undermining the local farmers' production of corn. But to respond, I think you're onto something quite essential, it is a global community we all live in. The poverty that we see, certainly in Latin America, perhaps other places, is linked to the U.S. economy in many, many ways. U.S. foreign assistance often is so conditioned that eventually it gets back here at any rate, in two and three and fourfold. So in a sense, we put money out there and it just revolves back into the hands of the strata of major money interests. Huh? It's all conditioned along that line. In order, we live the way we do at such a high level of lifestyle at the expense of much of the rest of the world. And so it is linked. Huh? Often
the rest of the world and nature.
Yeah, nature, very good. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's not just a human reality. Yeah.
Often they talk about parallel economies in countries, but that it's one economy. It's an economy that depends on many people who are unemployed or underemployed. It depends on that to keep wages low and the like.
How are we doing up in the balcony here?
If we're Dan,
yeah.
If we're giving going to give foreign assistance to the new developing countries, they're developing perhaps, but like Al says, on a Christian, maybe that element of Christianity will come through in a lot of those countries. But at the same time, I'm concerned, just as Al is, that we're going to westernize those countries, which will indeed create a further depletion of our environment. Because those countries, Poland, and you just name any of the countries, even Russia, and we're going to go in there and give them assistance, we're going to go in there and develop their industry, and what is that going to do to the atmosphere, which we are degrading much more than any other place in the world. Well, I don't know what percentage, Al has a percentage of, but we're going to go down in there and assist them to help further pollute our atmosphere.
So some of the problem may be that short-term aid may be actually a long-term obstacle if we're not being aware of the kind of environmental impact.
I don't think in Eastern Europe, though, if we gave them aid, that would help them because their pollution is incredibly bad.
They're worse than we
didn't realize that. They are much, much worse than we in the United States are today. It's nearly an order of magnitude all over Eastern Europe. So I would say that, I don't know if we should give them money or not, but that's another subject. But if we did, we would significantly help them because they have just terrible pollution problems.
Are we putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than any other place, any other country?
No.
Per capita, Luxembourg probably does more than anybody else.
Than the United States?
Per capita. Yeah, I asked the ambassador from Luxembourg, I said, you must have a terrible amount, and he says, no, it's our neighbors that have the difficulty.
We put 5 pounds a person, the average in the world is 1 pound a person.
Yeah, but that's an interesting phenomenon, because it may be accurate what you're saying, but that does not mean that in Europe, and like Latin America, Mexico City, have you all been to Mexico City?
Oh.
It's incredibly polluted. Nothing compared to our city. So, and that's typical of many, many cities.
In China.
Oh.
Black, just going there for a visit.
Yeah, but the fact is that most of us have automobiles or other things that depend on the use of carbon fuel things. But even the peasants in El Salvador are contributing in some ways to air pollution and pollution of the streams. So
our policy is that we force third world countries to cut down their forests in order to have land to grow, and in order for cattle ranches to develop that send their cattle here. And it's, we are the, I mean, in a sense, we're participating in the destruction. Brazil has 337 million tons of carbon dioxide a year from the burning of their forests. That's a significant contribution to global warming. And they will continue to do that unless our policies and our help and the world's help helps them create a viable economic system in the, all over the third world. We'll just destroy the whole rainforest of the world.
Jane's been trying to get in, and then Scott has a question too.
Yeah, well, this is still on environment. I mean, I think it's a really, really good question. But as many people have said, they don't, it's not necessarily, I mean, developing countries are not in a pristine world now with no pollution, where everything is going well, and if only our industry stays out, things will go well. A classic example is that people destroy their environments themselves, cutting trees when they're desperate for cash. I mean, they're so poor, and this is going on all over. I mean, it has nothing to do with us, but for various reasons, they're so poor, they cut down their trees in order to sell them. So development can, I mean, development, I mean, is a bad word, but I mean, economic aid, let's say, can sometimes help the environment. The other thing I was going to say is I think there is a new awareness. I sort of follow the development literature, but especially for Africa, so I'm not sure so much about the other continents. But how environment and development go together. Even the World Bank, which for many of us has for years been the epitome of bad development projects. I mean, they're usually catastrophic for the environment. They're even finally waking up, have an environmental division now, and I believe that all their projects have to go through an environmental assessment. A lot more bureaucracy, it's true, and it by no means means that things will go better now, but at least the awareness is starting to come that these two things have to go together. I mean, it used to also be that pro-development ignored the environment. That was a very predominant view, I think, through the 60s, 70s, something like that. I mean, that they couldn't go together. But I think that we're gradually seeing ways in that they can, that there is a sustainable development that's possible, and that's what we have to work on.
Scott, you had your hand up.
I wanted to ask whether we're discussing a topic that would be something a few years from now that we'll look back and say, do you remember when the U.S. used to be involved in aid?
Involved in what?
I'm wondering if we're talking about something that will soon be a matter of history, which is significant U.S. aid to others.
Involved in aid at all.
Yeah. With the, I don't have all these numbers, but what is our indebtedness now? $1 trillion or?
No, about three.
$3 trillion, right? Mm-hmm. Didn't we triple it over the last year or two? With the massive, we have this massive commitment to the state of Israel, which consumes what, about half of the, is that right? Half of what? Our aid?
Israel and Egypt together are a lot. Egypt's also very high.
Yeah.
About $3 billion.
And with the debt of the third world owed to us, which are they really ever going to pay that? They're not going to pay that back, right? They're going to probably walk away from it. What do you think? That would leave us in
They'll live with it.
What?
They'll live with it.
They'll live with it?
Yeah.
Do we have the political will in this country to be significantly involved in aid anymore? Or are we talking about an issue that will soon fade from the scene altogether? I'd be curious what your opinion is.
It's a tough one because it's very difficult for me to make the case that helping desperately poor African nations, which many are, is in our own interest. I'd like to say that it's clear, and if you look at things rationally, it is, but I'm not sure that it always is. So it has to come from a motivation outside that really normal U.S. foreign policy objective of security for us, etc. I mean, we really have to have a commitment because it's the right thing to do. I think it's going to need a big push. I have no idea what the answer is, but it shows that we really need to push, because I think that aid does help. I mean, I guess that's why I don't want to come down too hard on the side of all the problems that aid causes. A country like Namibia right now is a really exciting place for us to put. Hundreds of millions should be going in there. Mm-hmm. Instead, as you know, it's $500,000 is our total. So, I mean, it's like 1/1,000th of what Poland is getting. And it's just as exciting a new democracy. The countries are desperately in need of it, and you have to step out of your own self-interest. I know people at Holden do easily, but we need to continue to encourage our fellow church members and whatever that there's a greater good than the U.S. self-interest.
Well, I'll ask a question then, maybe of Val or someone. When one's Christian commitment or desire to have that motivation that Jane describes prompts them as a citizen to try to be part of the process and implement changes that would maybe direct more aid toward Namibia and less toward Israel or whatever, but a different kind of distribution. Is there any, I feel really impotent that there isn't any real hope of influencing that because of the processes that govern policy are not those altruistic policy, motivations that you describe. Is there any hope at all of making any change in the way those things are directed?
You got to come to Al's fifth session, which is how to get your voice heard in government.
I talked to you about that.
Well, or anybody can answer that.
Yeah, I think there is some hope for it. I'll tell you then how to do it. Can I respond? I would just simply wait for that. No, he's giving us the same speech tonight as he did then. Besides, Dan had cut me off. He said, if we talk now more than that. I'd just like to respond to Scott. We got about, if everything goes as it is now, we got about 20 years before that occurs. Because we're going to depend on the Social Security Trust Fund. And that's a tax that taxes everybody the same up to a certain level, and keep raising that. Raises an enormous amount of money, and the growth is going to be substantial. That's really what we're using, so it doesn't look like a deficit. But when we come to the point where people are going to start drawing on that in about 2010 to 2015, when it's going to start evaporating, and then either we have to borrow money or else tax for that, because it won't be there, because we already used it up. And that's when, if we don't do anything between now and then, there won't be any foreign aid. We'll need some. Mm-hmm. We've got a really serious problem on our hands, I think, about that one. But maybe we'll be aware of that sooner than that.
Maybe in the interest of heating things up a bit, I'd just like to say a concern I have about all the foreign assistance that takes place outside the realm of our so-called democratic government. We haven't addressed military intervention strategies at all, and I think that's a much bigger part of the whole picture. And I'd like to hear some discussion about that.
Do you have a perspective on that, Jang, you want to share, or do you?
Well, I'd like to hear something about low-intensity conflict and CIA involvement and all the other kinds of foreign intervention that we do that is not, food to the poor.
Well, the two major nations in the world have the former head of their secret police at the president's now.
Case closed.
Whatever that means, I don't know. I think it's kind of interesting.
In reading Jack Nelson Pallmeyer's book, he talks about what I got out of it, that all these foreign interventions or reach outs, if you will call them, are being, they're sort of finely tuned and orchestrated in terms of having enough acceptable image on them, like maybe aid to Africa is truly altruistic, and that's for the positive side of the image. But underneath this positive side of the image is a lot of military intervention that gets obscured then. But the end result of all the intervention is that America expands its interests and it expands its control and it sustains its empire. But it's got this finely tuned sense of control on good image and true altruism versus deceitful and clandestine goals that are not morally defensible in a wide public arena or in a wide media revelation, if you will.
I figure there's a lot less than meets the eye.
Less.
I think we conjure up all kinds of things. On the conservative side, they're all worried about trilateral?
Commission,
yeah. I don't think there's all those sinister, evil things going on lurking out there. I know you have to keep an eye on them, and our own CIA, and you can talk about, boy, we dreamed up all kinds of sinister things that the KGB was going to do to us, too.
Yeah,
I think there's something unique now. Is you can't hide the news the way you once were able to do. And as ornery as the press is towards public officials in this country, they sure got all, they're a lot more snoopy than they ever were, and they aren't letting you get by with as much personal things that happened than before. And with the satellites, I think that the news is getting around. People are finding out more about it. And so whenever people start getting news they didn't have before, then I think they're more suspicious. There's a lot more underneath there.
Yeah.
than they thought was there before. That's why my comments is a lot less than meets the eye.
Well, digging for personal stuff has more sensationalism than it does to digging for why so many people are dying and suffering and starving in Central America through low-intensity conflict. So it's a matter of this gets results if you dig into this, and it builds our ego.
But I think eventually the press is going to go after it. Does go after that as well. I mean, it takes a while for them to do it. But, you know, there's a lot of changes that were made because of a free press. That helped us, and that's what happened in Vietnam. I think it's what's happening in a lot of the countries that had closed societies. The news is getting out. People are finding out about it. Then they can make the right decision because they're informed that way.
Yeah, it seems they got enough power to make their decisions come.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, if they got the knowledge, they'll be getting more power.
Any other response to Jackie's question? Or
as just we knew a lot more about the way in which we do conduct that level of low intensity conflict. It is a major. We don't know the costs really, because it's not revealed to us. It doesn't even come out in Congress. It's not revealed in those budgets. It's hidden.
It's obscured. There's a strategy.
So we don't know the real costs.
But it isn't that there aren't people that you know who know something about it. And there's a group of people in Congress who are elected by their own constituents who have the full and total knowledge of that.
But just
there are quite a few of them that refuse to be informed, and as far as I know, they're out of those positions.
What about like the Iran-Contra situation? Was that carried out with the knowledge of Congress?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No.
And that's,
that,
I think...
But, you know, that did come out. I mean, our system does work to that extent. Not that people don't try to pull wool over their eyes. That's just my view of it. You let the other people...
I was just going to echo a little bit what Jackie said, a concern that I have had. Al, you mentioned that there seemed to be an increasing awareness of human rights as an emphasis in aid. But what I have seen that's been terribly disturbing in the last 10 years, that again is kind of low intensity conflict, is a using of almost in the forefront saying, oh yes, we're real concerned about human rights and we're going to make sure that's the issue here. And then a covert, sort of secondary, often of military aid. I mean, what's going on in El Salvador right now, in other parts of the world, where there's this front to kind of keep, especially the American public, happy. That yes, we're really concerned about human rights and we're concerned about that. And then a secondary front going on that is working against that. And I see so much contradiction in what our U.S. policy goals are through that. And that's what I just think is incredibly destructive.
I agree, but the reason why I asked the question of Phil and Mavis' time just before devotions is that I have a hope that no longer can we point to that fear of the Soviet Union working through Cuba, Nicaragua, and so forth, and therefore we have to take all that covert action in order to protect ourselves from that change now is going to cause an enormous change in the public opinion and the way the Congress responds to that in regards to aid and covert action in the future. So, I mean, that's just a hope where I am now, because you try and look at what causes major changes in public thinking that is going to force the opinion of all the people, not only in the reflected through the Congress into the other parts of government. And I just think that will have something. Yeah, because you all get by finally, you know, the poor congressmen go back home again and they don't want to be accused of being pro-communist. And that's over with in the world. I don't know what they're going to use on them.
into terrorism.
Terrorism.
We're at the end of our time. And I just want to thank the panelists and the other, and all of you for participation. I think holding forums tend to generate more questions than they answer, and that's a sign of a good forum. But I hope people will continue with these thoughts and questions and carrying them on into the week and the sessions we've got. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.